One, two.
Welcome to NPR's Culturetopia. If you're wondering what happened to your NPR books or movies podcast, this is our new podcast to replace both of those. It's going to be the very best arts pieces on National Public Radio. It's going to have books, it's going to have movies, but it'll also have music, TV, digital culture, and whatever else we think can fit. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog, Monkey See. And I'm here with
Netta Ulibi, arts reporter for National Public Radio. So we're going to look back over the very best pieces from the last week. And we have quite an assortment for you. It's a regular candy box of arts pieces.
Today, we've got a piece about a movie about aspiring baseball players in the Dominican Republic. We're also going to take a trip to Turkey to look at the relationship between Turkey in the movies and Turkey in real life. We'll look back at a little-known man who created a treasure trove of U.S. culture. But first, a really, really creepy phenomenon.
On Weekend Edition Sunday, Robert Smith talked with an author who looks at great geniuses who all died at the age of 27.
Mankind has always been fascinated by young death.
That's Eric Siegelstadt. His fascination with young death compelled him to spend years researching a ghoulish list known as the 27s. The list includes Kurt Cobain, who died 15 years ago today at age 27.
Hi, I'm Kurt Loder with an MTV News special report. The body of Nirvana leader Kurt Cobain was found in a house in Seattle on Friday morning, dead of an apparently self-inflicted shotgun blast to the head.
Before Kurt Cobain, there were others.
I got stones in my pathway, and my road seemed dark at night.
Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, blues pioneer Robert Johnson, none of them lived to see their 28th birthday. Eric Siegelstadt tells the stories of these artists and others in the book he co-wrote, The 27s, The Greatest Myth of Rock and Roll.
It's a strange number. It's also happens right around that time in your life where most people go from the stage of youth to the stage of maturity.
Well, you profile more than 20 of the 27s, but whose story did you find most compelling?
I guess Pete Ham from Badfinger is a pretty compelling story because he did live his life pretty purely. He didn't have any strong drug addictions, yet he was victim to crooked managers and record label quarrels that rendered him penniless and frustrated, and he ended his life by hanging himself in his studio garage.
And the interesting thing about Pete Ham is that a lot of his music really did live on. That's what we see about a lot of these 27s, that they continue to have an impact today.
It's true. He's penned some incredible pop classics.
Pop classics such as the song Without You. And, you know, as you said, he wasn't necessarily involved in the sort of reckless lifestyle of some of these people, like Jim Morrison or Janis Joplin, but he did have a sense of being lost there at the end. They all seemed to have to share that in their 27th year, that they didn't quite know where they were going.
It's probably difficult once you hit that age. If you've been part of this game for a little while and you either feel invincible or you feel frustrated or maybe even both, how do you top yourself in Jimi Hendrix's case? How do you top yourself? You've already changed the sound of guitar and the sound of rock and roll forever. And where do you go from there without becoming idiosyncratic?
Yeah, his guitar slung across his back. His dusty boots is his.
You know, the deaths of these rock stars at the age of 27 really changed the way we look at rock music. I mean, in the early part of the century, you never probably thought that musician was one of the most dangerous professions. And yet, you write in your book, we now expect rock stars to die before we do. So what do you mean by that?
Janis Joplin once said, people, whether they know it or not, like their blues singers miserable. And I think that's part of it. We need the rock and roll musicians to be out there for us, to feel what we feel, and to be what we wannabe that we can't be. It's an emotional book, but at the same time, it's a book that celebrates the lives and the legacies of all these musicians. And we want people to remember who they were and what wonderful music they created while they were here.
The immortal Janis Joplin.
Indeed.
And the immortal Linda Holmes. What are your thoughts about this piece?
Listening to it, it's very interesting because obviously with these artists, there are decades and decades, many, many years of music that's lost when they die early. I have complicated feelings about the idea of focusing on sort of these young, very, very sad deaths in a way that feels, I don't know, a little bit gimmicky.
Okay, here's something that's not gimmicky. It was the movie Half Nelson that was directed by Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden, and it was about this young crack addict school teacher. But the filmmakers have made a new movie. It's about the young Dominicans who want to become Major League Baseball players.
Yeah, the Dominican Republic is definitely one of the major training grounds for professional baseball players in the U.S., absolutely.
So these directors made up a movie. It's a scripted movie about one of the young men who goes to one of these academies that's in the Dominican Republic that's funded by Major League Baseball. And in the movie, he goes from that academy to the United States. He's 19 years old. He's a pitcher. And his name is Miguel Sugar Santos. And it's all about how his struggle to try to make it in the big time. So the filmmakers, Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, joined All Things Considered's Melissa Block, and she asked them about the pressures faced by these kids in real life.
Well, there's tremendous pressures. You know, I mean, first of all, they're very poor, so there's a lot of pressure from their families to succeed, and not just to succeed as a baseball player and feel pride for that, but to pull their families out of poverty. And we became really interested in the process that these guys go through where they're taken out of their familiar environment and put into small minor league towns all over the country and expected to perform at the same level that they were able to perform at in their familiar environments. And when they don't know the language or the customs or the culture of their new environment, how does that affect their ability to perform on the field?
Tell us about the actor who's playing Sugar in this movie.
Yeah, El Henis. Well, we were casting the film. We were driving all over the Dominican Republic. We would pull up at a baseball field, break out a video camera, and invite everybody on that field to come be interviewed for a potential role in the movie. And El Henis was number 452.
This is El Henis Parasoto.
That's right, out of about 600 people.
Never acted before.
That's right. He'd never had any acting aspirations. He likes to tell us that, when we invited him to talk to us for the casting session, we asked him, oh, would you like to be an actor? And he said yes, because that's what he thought that we wanted to hear. But he'd grown up, like most boys in the Dominican Republic, with aspirations to become a professional baseball player, and those hadn't panned out. He never got signed by a team. But there he was playing on the weekend with his friends, and we met him. And, he had that special, that thing where you just want to watch him.
I think one of my favorite moments in this movie, it's a small thing, but Sugar's given a huge break. He's invited to spring training in Phoenix. There are a bunch of new Dominican players, and they've met up with another Dominican who's been there for a little while, and they go to a diner to get breakfast.
Okay, boys, ready?
French toast, please.
Okay, who's next?
French toast.
So they're all saying French toast because they don't know any words. They don't know any English. And for a long time, Sugar is eating nothing but French toast for breakfast.
That was one of the most common things that we kept hearing again and again from these players. Everybody said the hardest thing was ordering food, trying to go to a restaurant and order what you... And even if you have it all planned in your head, you go to McDonald's and you say, oh, I want the cheeseburger meal. Then they ask you, what kind of soda do you want with it? Or, you know, do you want it supersized? And there are all these questions that they aren't prepared for, and some of the most hilarious and heartbreaking stories we heard that way.
What else were you hearing from folks when you talked to them about the culture shock? People who had, you know, never been on an airplane, never been to the States, landing in these small towns all around the country.
Well, there's a lot of isolation and loneliness that these guys feel, and they might come from a place and a culture that's very festive, and they're always with people. There's always something going on in the streets, and then at least in the way that we depicted in the film, in these small farm towns, there's not much to do.
Yeah, Sugar in the movie ends up in Bridgetown, Iowa, playing for the Bridgetown Swing. He's taken in by a host family, Helen and Earl Higgins, who live on a farm, and they do this all the time. They take in young Dominican prospects. Let's listen.
No drinking. No cervezas in the casa. No chicas in the bedroom.
I already told him that one.
Okay. What about quiet time?
Oh, right. There's no real curfew, but you must be quiet after 10.
Dias. Shh. After Diaz. Huh?
Ding. Okay.
See? Si. That's all we ask. It's our job to keep you healthy and focused on baseball.
And we take pride in that.
Take a lot of pride in that. They love their baseball.
Yeah, but if the players stop performing, they'll turn on them in an instant.
You know, when I was watching the film, you know, I thought I knew where it was headed. It would have been easy to make that predictable movie. Maybe it wouldn't have been easy, but you could imagine making it. And you decided not to do that story. It's a different thing you're trying to tell here.
Yeah, we had no interest in making a traditional sports movie. We're not big fans of that genre of film. But when we started doing our research, we went up to the Bronx. We live here in New York. We went up to the Bronx where there's a very big Dominican population, and there's a field in Crotona Park where all these guys who have been through a very similar journey, they play on weekends and they play for fun. And we went up there and we talked to them, and we started to hear their stories, and we knew pretty quickly, fairly early on in the research stage, that this is where the journey was going to end. This is the end of the movie. And we kind of worked our way backwards. So we knew this wasn't going to be the rags to riches I don't want to say it's not a happy ending, because I think it is an uplifting ending, not to give too much away. But we didn't want to tell the story of the guy who makes it and becomes a millionaire.
When you hear that there is a movie that is called Sugar, you would not necessarily automatically think, I bet that is the name of a Dominican baseball player. It is Sugar.
It's Sugar.
So we're going to talk about a wonderful person right now. This is an obituary that we did actually a few weeks ago about a guy named Archie Green. He was a teacher, a folklorist, and an advocate who documented the culture of workers. NPR's Tom Cole, who happens to be my editor, documented his life.
Archie Green was a worker. Never mind that he wrote 8 books and hundreds of articles, had a PhD, produced records. When asked what he was, he'd often say, a shipwright. He spent the years before and after World War II in the shipyards along San Francisco Bay. Green said he had to work hard to learn the job, and he was proud of it. But he left the shipyards for school.
Archie combined the two big loves of his life. Folklore, which is all about knowing people and interviewing people and making a relationship, and the other was work.
That's Peggy Bulger, the director of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. She says Green had a knack for getting people to talk about themselves. Green told NPR in 2005 about a research trip during which a woman, dying in a nursing home, volunteered to sing for him.
Pity me all day, pity me all day. Pity me, my darling, and take me far away. Yonder stands that spinning room boat.
It's apparently our oldest industrial ballad in continuous oral tradition. It's a camera snapshot into working conditions in textile mills in New England.
All I say to you factory girls, come see me if you can.
Archie Green's real talent, though, may have been his ability to inspire others to dig up these songs and stories. Musician Stephen Wade remembers seeing Green one day in a hallway in the Library of Congress.
And all these librarians and folklorists and administrators were standing around him. And there was this guy in a T-shirt. And his hands was in the air, and they were listening to him just freely associate. And I realized that's Socrates in a T-shirt.
Like the Greek philosopher, Archie Green was known for prodding his listeners to think and act. And not just academics. Mike Muniz met Green in 1982. Muniz was a California pile driver, one of the construction workers who sinks the foundations for bridges and buildings. He'd been collecting the history of his union, never dreaming he would put it down on paper. Green pushed him to write.
He was there every step of the way. He never wrote anything for me. He would never do the work. He made sure I did all the work. And that was one of Archie's gifts, is that he was truly an organizer. He was an organizer in a different sense, but he was a union organizer, and he could get people to stand up and start something and finish it.
Muniz finished a book about pile driving. Archie Green even managed the unlikely task of organizing members of Congress, lobbying them relentlessly to pass the American Folklife Preservation Act of 1976, unanimously. It established the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. Green's goal was to have the workers' stories told in the Marble Mansion, to bring academia and the working world together, to help show the plurality that makes democracy possible. That was the end to all of his means, as he wrote in one of his books, read by Stephen Wade.
Do we ask too much by calling for equity and democracy in cultural life? The peasant fiddler is as worthy as a symphony violinist. The village cobbler, more precious than a pair of boots.
Tom Cole, NPR News.
5 cents that you gave them, and just go away, and please let us be.
It should be mentioned that Archie Green was 91 years old when he died.
Someone else who always looks for culture no matter where he goes is our film critic, Bob Mondello. When he went to Turkey on vacation, he just couldn't help himself. He came back with a story about Turkey and the movies.
What I know of Istanbul, I learned at the movies. It's a city filled with intrigue. James Bond's ferry ride up the Bosporus and From Russia with Love.
That's all you are interested in.
But if you tell me about the machine, afterwards we won't always be working on the company's time.
That terrifying Turkish prison in Midnight Express. The Sultan's treasure room in Topkapi.
The Istanbul Emeralds, the most protected jewels in the world, have been stolen.
If I'm in Turkey, I figured that's the stuff I should see. So I went hunting for it. Why, just a month ago, I was watching The International with Clive Owen slinking through this way spooky underground, mysterious, super-secret reservoir. A mysterious, super-secret reservoir that it turns out I have to stand in line for now that I'm actually here. And what do I find? Piped-in classical music, a gazillion tourists, no Clive Owen, but... we knew that, right? The most surprising thing about the Basilica Cistern, as this tourist site is known outside suspense movies, is that the spooky movie-style lighting you see in The International was already there. Hollywood just had to turn on the cameras. But that can't be true of the grim, disgusting prison in Midnight Express. According to 3 guidebooks and several local merchants, it was just 2 blocks from the cistern, so I go searching. And hallelujah, in what was once the prison yard, I find evidence. Big, rusting iron locks, suitable for shackling Brad Davis after he steals a blanket. If he was cold and needed a blanket today, he could just ring for room service. Those big iron locks I found, wall decorations in what is now the bar of a Four Seasons hotel. And so it goes with the movie site sightseeing. The Topkapi Palace Museum's precious dagger, which Melina Mercury describes in the movie Topkapi as being
crafted with 4 greatest emeralds the world has ever known,
would seem like a bigger deal if it weren't displayed among emerald-encrusted teapots. The real Grand Bazaar? It's every bit as jewel and rug-crammed as it was in The Accidental Spy.
Somebody help!
Though not quite as madcap, without a naked Jackie Chan kicking up clouds of curry powder and swinging from the rafters in a Turkish bath.
Thank you!
Local vendors Errol and Nussum still remember that stunt.
Jackie Chan was up there in the Çemberli Taş Hammam, and he made it hang on the chandelier.
Indiana Jones, everybody knows it, and they were in Istanbul as well.
And carousing at that same Turkish bath, so I pay it a visit to discover whether there's any drama in what people who don't swing from chandeliers do there.
After 10, 15 minutes, you spat like on the picture over there, the first one. Uh-huh. The masseur with the glove, they do the peeling, scrub the dead skin off you. Okay. That whole procedure takes about half an hour, but after that, if you want to stay any longer inside and enjoy the steam room, it's up to you.
Half an hour of steam and the very sweaty ministrations of an elderly gentleman who wants to bend me in directions I don't normally bend is actually more than enough, and it helps me realize that I'm not finding much drama in all this movie site sightseeing. Probably won't find it at the Istanbul train station's Orient Express restaurant, either. But I know it's here, so maybe if I put on my theater critic hat, I can find it. I board a plane and fly over the battlefields bloodied by Mel Gibson in Gallipoli to visit an older, non-cinematic site of drama, the crumbling ruins of Ephesus, where Antony and Cleopatra, the real ones, saw the smash hit comedies and tragedies of a couple of millennia ago in the largest amphitheater in the ancient world.
This was the entrance gateway for the spectators.
Tour guide Ilker Etti.
Let's go down to the orchestra to check the acoustic here, to check the echo. But to give you a rough idea about the acoustic here, let me clap my hands.
Though we're out in the open air, it sounds remarkably as if we're in an enclosed space when Ilker claps. Sounds here have bounce and presence, theatricality, you might say. Good for the drama I've been chasing, and for music, too, though maybe too good for amplified music, because it made an entryway collapse.
This part had fallen down after 1992, after the summer festival, one of the world-famous singers, Sting. Today we still have summer festivals, but only classical music concerts, you know, no more loudspeakers.
The surrounding city of Ephesus, once a port, but now several miles inland because its river silted up, was, our guide says, the second largest city in the Roman Empire. And how do archaeologists looking at bleached marble ruins know that? Turns out the box office gods told them. Only the nobility, the top 10% of Roman society, could attend the Grand Theater, so size, in this case, matters.
If you don't have any information about the census they had in Roman cities, always try to check the seating to the Grand Theaters, surplus that number with 10 times, you will get the total population. That's how we know that population in Ephesus was 250,000, because the Grand Theater has a seating capacity 24,000. Okay?
Accommodating that many Roman citizens required carving a huge semicircular bowl into a hillside. The Romans built up from a broad stage more than 60 curved rows of solid marble seating. Steeply spaced rows, let's note, and to check out how those ancient acoustics hold up in the cheap seats, I'm heading to the very top. Climbing up the steps now. A lot of them are getting old. There we go. Whew. At the top, the nearest people, some kids playing on the stage, will be nearly a football field away below me. And in theory, I'll be able to hear them anyway.
By the time I get here, all you're going to be here, able to hear, is me breathing.
I'll hear them over my breathing because this vast open space, though stripped of most of its marble through the centuries, will do the work of projecting for them. So can I?
All right.
They're speaking more or less normally. An actor declaiming lines would be clearly audible way up here.
I guess it's really important that he would be audible to 24,000 people because the view from this spot, it's pretty breathtaking. And not just because I'm out of breath.
A view of the far-off Aegean, which would have been a lot closer before the river delta silted up, with the huge ancient city of Ephesus spread out before it. Today, above the ruins of that city's market and the remains of a grand processional road, storm clouds scud across a grassy plain, providing a theater that's hosted audiences for more than two millennia with visual drama that is elemental and ageless. I'm Bob Mondello.
Linda, what do you think is more amazing? The kind of ancient technology that enabled that guy to be able to declaim without any kind of amplification other than his own self and the acoustics, or the technology that's enabling us to podcast right now? Oh, I don't know. I'd have to say the first one, but especially because, you know, I've never actually heard anybody admit, you know, Sting broke our theater. I think that's my sort of my favorite tidbit.
Well, hopefully no one's little white headphones have cracked during the course of this podcast.
Oh, I would certainly hope not. And I think it certainly speaks to the constant bravery of journalists that Bob was willing to record himself climbing all of those rows of seats.
We'd like to thank you for joining us on Culturetopia. This is Netta Ulibi.
And I'm Linda Holmes.
Talk to you next week.